Hi, Rick.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Good. And you?
I'm doing okay. I should introduce you. First of all, I am Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Hendrik Hertzberg, and we're lucky to have you because you are an eminent journalist now at The New Yorker, where your work can be found in the front of the book, as we used to say, often in the Talk of the Town section. And you have been editor of the New Republic not once but twice. I'm sure you have vivid memories from those days.
And many of which include you.
Some of which do include me, I must say. And you've done other things. You were a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, and you've compiled an impressive body of work, much of which, or some of which, is in the book Politics, which I'm holding up now, your kind of collected works. And I've got to say, I was, you know, this thing is like, has no pictures and yet runs nearly 700 pages, and that's a lot of writing, and I was kind of surprised because in my experience with you, you actually spent most of every day avoiding writing.
I've spent most of my life doing that.
So how did this happen then?
Well, the same way that the Grand Canyon got deep, little by little.
Well, anyway, we're lucky to have you, and we're going to talk about something of yours in a little while that is either your passion or your obsession or your hobby horse, depending on how charitable you feel like being, and that is this national popular vote thing, a way of winding up with a system where we elect the president, where the person who's president is actually the person who got the most votes. And there's a very clever, you know, you're part of a kind of a campaign that's probably made more progress than people realize that very cleverly would get this done without the necessity of a constitutional amendment. So we'll talk about your view of the virtues of that and how you're doing on that in a little while. But first, of course, there's a news flash today, which is that it turns out that the president of the United States was born in the United States. Did you hear that?
I know there's tremendous consternation everywhere. Markets weak, you name it.
It's just, for me, it's just a paradigm shift. I mean, but anyway, that turns out to be the case. And you had written recently about Donald Trump, who, of course, apparently, who was taking credit for occasioning this this release of important data, and probably does get credit, I guess. But you wrote a talk piece about him recently, right?
I did, yeah. A comment. It's not really part of Talk of the Town comment. I mean, it's in the Talk of the Town, but it's sort of a separate department bureaucratically. Well, I mean, it is pretty the chutzpah of Trump in taking credit for that. I'm trying to think of what would be the right comparison for that. You know, the tsunami claiming credit for the renewal of the Japan's electric power industry. I don't know. It's pretty nervy.
In other words, as a matter of strict causality, it's a defensible claim. But was it worth the damage you did in the process? Or
yeah, and I mean he's acting as if it was as if this was sort of like a Perry Mason trick on his part.
Yeah.
You know, but all along he knew the answer all along.
Yeah.
Well, of course he did know the answer all along. But I guess he expected to wring it out for a little while longer.
Yeah. Now, in this piece you wrote, you made the claim that actually, although Trump kind of strikes me, I mean, a number of people strike me these days as the kind of people who are suddenly getting attention as candidates who would not have gotten attention in days gone by. But you actually dredged up an historical comparison to him.
I did. I examined joke candidacies through history. It does seem, you know, here's a professional entertainer. At least that's one of his professions, and one can think of quite a few precedents for it. Not least Ronald Reagan, I suppose. The one I came up with was Bishop Homer Tomlinson, the three-time candidate of the Theocratic Party,
mm-hmm.
who was from Queens. Who lived in Queens, and Donald Trump is also from Queens. So they're both the New Yorkers from within a couple of miles of each other. I thought that was significant. They both they both had a certain modesty about them. Bishop Tomlinson crowned him, toured the world after his third presidential run. He toured the world, carrying with him his own robe, crown, and throne, which I guess he had to check through. Crowned himself king of about 80 countries, and in Red Square he crowned himself Tsar of the Russias, and wound up by crowning himself king of the world. So that seemed pretty Trumpian too.
Yeah. But is now he most recently ran for president in 1968, right?
He ran. He made noises in. oh, you mean Bishop Tomlinson,
yes.
Not Trump? Yes, that's right. No, he. I think he skipped 68. 68 was a little too. The field was too crowded with crazies in 68. Pegasus the Pig was running. Richard Nixon, all kinds of curious people. Mm. 72 was his last campaign.
72.
I think so. Yeah, I haven't got the piece in front of me, and so it's not checking sure, but I think it was 72 was his last. He certainly ran in 64 and 72, or maybe he ran. He actually started. He ran for everything else too, by the way, not just president. He also ran for alderman, mayor of Chicago,
uh-huh.
governor of Illinois. Lots of things. Senator.
And
it was sort of.
But I mean, I don't remember. I mean, he did not become as. I mean, his candidacy didn't reach the prominence of a Trump candidacy, right? Because I do have this. I do have the sense that the crazies are getting more attention now.
Yeah, they are. And Trump only kind of underlines it because he's more overtly crazy. He's from a background that reeks of crazy. But the legit candidates, or the ones that nominally have resumes that look like they belong to political figures, that's where the crazies are coming from now. I mean, in the current lineup, Republican lineup, you've got one crazy ex one-term governor, one crazy congresswoman. One crazy former Speaker of the House, and they're all pretty much in the crazy joke category.
Yeah. Now, would you say? I mean, I might slightly qualify your characterization, but I do consider them part of the same genre. Would you say that Gingrich was crazy all along? It seems to me he's saying. I mean, he always said kind of. Slightly flaky, crackpotty things, but they tended more to be innocuous, it seems to me, early on. And now he's into this, you know, there's a stealth jihadist living next door to you kind of mode that seems to me a little more dangerously crazy. Do you think Gingrich has gotten crazier?
I think that he's kind of transferred the brain cells that are devoted to being crazy. He's transferred them from kind of anodyne fields to directly into political poison.
Right.
I mean, he used to be, his craziness used to express himself in these kind of lovable ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his obsession with dinosaurs, for example, he was like a happy little boy when it came to dinosaurs. And as he often said, if he hadn't gone the way he did, he wanted to be a paleontologist when he was little.
Which in retrospect, I would have supported as his career path, but. Anyway.
And I think he probably would have been a pretty good paleontologist, although we might he does like to make things up too. You know, he's also been a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
Not particularly good science fiction writer, more of a Ron Hubbard than a Philip K. Dick.
Yeah. Well, he's a visionary. But, I know one thing he pointed out is that if one of the virtues of a robust American space program is it then wheelchair-bound, you know, paraplegics and so on can go up in space and not have the burden of gravity. And that was a good example of a kind of innocuous, eccentric thing to say. And
that's right. It's not, and there's a kind of, there's a sort of streak of kindness behind it.
Yeah, that was a nice thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very it didn't nice. Work out so far, but it was a nice thought.
And he was a great fan of Alvin Toffler and Futurism. Mm-hmm. And he loves grand, sweeping historical theories.
Totally.
They sort of classic comics versions of Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
With a little bit of I don't know, sort of, you know, Mormon enthusiasm thrown in there. It was I actually had a soft spot for Newt. But he's kind of gone sour, I think.
Yeah. Do you think there's a serious chance that any of these three people could be the candidate? Or wait, how many crazies? Well, counting Trump, that's four. You're saying Bachman, Palin, Newt, Trump.
Yeah. Is that the full crazy list? Well, I suppose you could kind of count Ron Paul, maybe because of the gold bug.
Yes.
Federal Reserve stuff. I mean, there's a touch of you know, Masonic conspiracy thing there.
Uh-huh.
But he's not really crazy like the others, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of, I'm not sure which candidates are Ayn Rand fans. Do you happen to know that offhand? I'm not sure if Santorum is. You know, Ayn Rand is such a militant atheist that it might be a problem for Santorum.
You mean which one is the official Ayn Rand candidate?
Yeah, is there an official Ayn Rand candidate
in
the
race yet? I would think Ron Paul would be the closest, but I don't really know her, like, foreign policy views and stuff and immigration views. He's a little bit of a libertarian aberration on immigration, isn't he?
He is. Yeah, and of course Ayn Rand was an immigrant.
Right.
You know, she had a funny accent and everything.
So then let's give him the benefit of the doubt and throw him into the crazy category.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would be five. Could any of them wind up being the nominee?
I can't. Maybe I lack imagination, but I can't see it. No.
Mm.
Can you imagine that, Bob? One of those being
I'm kind of superstitious about ever claiming that something I would find horrendous can't happen.
Safe. Yeah.
But. I have this fear of America going down a path psychologically. Like if there's a big terrorist attack or something, right? Mm-hmm. Then some of the things Gingrich is saying catching on. I have these fears.
He is
smarter than some of these people, than several of them, than Trump and Palin and Bachman, I'd say.
Yes, definitely smarter than them. Mm-hmm.
So I always worry about.
So I guess it's a question whether the country would go infantile and want reassurance,
mm-hmm.
in which case they wouldn't want one of these people, or if they would just kind of go crazy, if the country would go crazy and wound up and paranoid.
Yeah.
And then it's true that a lot of things have happened that look like jokes. In retrospect, well, Reagan again was one of those. So I suppose you could derive some reassurance from that because Reagan did not turn out as badly. And he turned out pretty badly in my view, but he didn't turn out as badly as I thought he might the first time I heard that he was interested in politics, which I guess was when he made was 1964 when he made the Goldwater appeal.
Yeah, no, you could make that case. I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing. I have a segue from this subject to your passion, obsession, hobby horse.
Mm-hmm.
The national direct vote or national popular vote?
It's called the national popular
NPV.
Vote.
NPV. Okay, here's the segue.
Go.
It seems to me that in a certain sense, I don't know my history well enough to say this, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong. The Electoral College was designed, among other things, to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president. Because originally, it was an actual deliberative body, was it not? I mean, wasn't the idea that the states would send their electors off to Washington and with some degree of autonomy left so that they were not bound to vote for a given candidate? And then they could kind of talk it over and stuff. But in the end, they were putting the decision in the hands of these elites, as a sociologist would say, or, you know, particularly well-educated people, whatever, right? Was that the original idea?
No, that's actually wrong in several ways, and is one of the many, many things that well-informed people believe
well,
about
I'm a good
the Electoral
example
College
of that.
That's not true.
Because I consider myself well-informed, and I believed it until just now.
Well, here's a couple of things that are wrong. The Electoral College, in the original vision of it, if you could call it that, does not go to Washington and deliberate.
That was a detail. Okay, go ahead.
Well, it's not such a detail because, in fact, the electors go to their state capital, and they cast their ballots, and then the ballots are sent. The count is sent. They're sent to Washington, and they're opened. The ballots are opened there, but there isn't any kind of a discussion. They're simply counted.
So there is no deliberation even at the state level.
Well, maybe there can be deliberation at the state level. I'm not sure about that. It's unclear because all the Constitution says is that the states shall appoint a number of electors equal to its congressional delegation. That is its number of representatives plus two for the senators in such a manner as the legislature thereof of that state may direct.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely up to the state legislatures how they do it. But the Constitution is specific about then the ballots going to the Capitol and all being open. The ballots all have to be cast on the same day.
Uh-huh.
And what the framers envisioned actually was that the Electoral College, so-called, it's not a term they used, that term does not appear in the... sorry about that.
What ringtone is that, Rick?
It's one of the ones offered by Condé Nast. It's less annoying than some of the other ones that they offer.
Okay.
Anyway, what the framers envisioned was that the Electoral College would be a sort of nominating convention. They knew that George Washington would be the first president and then he would basically be elected unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, they assumed that in a big country like the United States, where it took a month to get from one end of it to the other, that there would not be anybody who, except in extraordinary circumstances, with a big enough national reputation to be the choice of an absolute majority of electors.
Mm.
And that's what it takes to elect a president through the electoral vote. You have to have a majority. You know, it's not just who gets the most. And so in the way Article 2 explains it, Congress would then vote. The House of Representatives would then choose among the top five finishers.
Really?
Yeah. And the House of Representatives, the way the House of Representatives would do it is that each state delegation to the House would get one vote. So Rhode Island would have one vote. The smallest state, Virginia, the biggest state, would have one vote. And that's how the president would be chosen. Mm. And they assumed that that's the way it was going to be virtually all the time.
So ultimately, it was kind of an elite decision. I mean, made by representatives of the people, but not so much by the electors.
That's right. But whether it was done by the electors or by the House of Representatives, it has nothing to do with the high-minded explanations that you get in the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are spin, written by practical politicians trying to sell a compromise to the people.
Okay, so the high-minded we don't need to go too deeply.
Yeah, all the stuff about how protecting the small states and insulating from popular passions. And
right, that's what I meant.
Having elites do it. All that stuff, all that stuff is eyewash.
Right. The insulating reason, from popular passions stuff does capture the spirit of my question. And so it is, I mean, I didn't get that from nowhere. The founders themselves claimed that that was kind of part of the idea, although it sounds like...
And it was part of the idea, certainly it was part of the idea behind choosing senators indirectly rather than directly.
Sure.
And also, even more so, having them serve six-year terms instead of just two-year
uh-huh.
terms. That's the main way that we're supposed to insulate against popular passions.
Okay.
But the real reason for the Electoral College, for the idea of of states having electoral votes equal to the number of proportional to the number of congressional representatives was a dirty deal essentially between Rhode Island and South Carolina. Rhode Island, the tiny little state, and Carolina, South Carolina, the keystone of the slaveocracy, of slave states. The Electoral College, by giving states votes proportional to their congressional representation, the Electoral College builds a 3/5 rule into the choice of the president.
Builds a what into the choice of the president?
The 3/5 rule. The 3/5 rule, the rule whereby 3/5 of the slaves were counted in the population for congressional representation.
Oh, I see.
And that, and this isn't my opinion. This is in Madison's notes on his participation, notes on the Constitution, which is pretty much the only record we have from inside the Constitutional Convention. He, in pretty much that so many words, he says this.
Okay.
That the sticking point was to ensure that the slave states would have a bigger say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
much for high-mindedness.
So much for high-mindedness. Now, before we unveil, for those who don't know it already, before we unveil the clever plan for actually getting to, in effect, a direct national popular vote, and before we catch up on how far along you and your fellow fanatics, no, not fanatics, that's not a kind word, your fellow reformers are on this, tell me what is wrong with with the current system. Of course, one thing you can say is wrong is just, look, sometimes you wind up with a president who didn't win the popular vote, which, as I recall, happened not so long ago, right?
And of course, you do have to sort of accept the proposition that that the way we elect pretty much everybody else, namely count the votes, see who got the most votes, that person wins. You do have to sort of accept that that is a good idea. And that there has to be that to do it some other way, whereby, say, the person who gets the most votes doesn't win. You know, you need an extremely good reason to do that.
Okay, so what are the? I mean, aside from the fact that you'd like to just be really sure that if somebody wins a majority of the popular vote, they become president, which I would sign on to. What are other problems? You know, with the current system.
That really isn't the biggest problem.
Right.
I mean, it is a big problem in that, it's 4 out of 52 where it's gone wrong that way. And when it comes to, close elections, non-landslide elections, where the gap is less than 10 points between the top two candidates, it happens 1 out of 4, times. And, you know, in the last several elections, so I guess if you go back starting with 1960, 60 was close enough to be in the danger zone. 60, 68, 76, 92. You not just 2000, 2004 also. If 50,000 votes switch in Ohio in 2004, and Kerry would have been president after losing the popular vote by 3 million. That's the problem that most people immediately think about when they think about this proposal. But that, again, that does happen less than a majority of the time. But what does happen every single time is that the vast majority of the country is left out of the general election campaign.
Because the politicians focus on the swing states.
The swing states is where it all happens. And that is bad, not just because the candidates don't pay attention to those states, which they don't, and the people in them. They don't pay attention to the states and the people in them, but also because grassroots politics, organizing, participation is pointless in those states, in 4/5 or 9/10 of the country. There's just no point in going door to door with your neighbors, having a coffee clutch, you know, getting in earnest discussions with them, trying to persuade them. It's pointless in those places. That, to me, is the real, what's really bad about the about the current system. Yeah, it also distorts the issues because candidates focus on the issues just in the swing states. Mm-hmm. So the parochial interests of a few states are arbitrarily elevated mm-hmm. above
do you think our policy toward Cuba would actually be significantly different if Florida weren't a swing state?
Yes. Uh-huh. And our policy toward coal would be significantly different if West Virginia weren't a swing state. And I don't know, I guess if the big swing states were, Vermont, Massachusetts, and California, then marriage equality, then gay marriage would be as sacrosanct as gun rights. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't necessarily be an improvement, depending on your point of view. Well, I think it would be an improvement. But what would be really nice would be to have a national election fought out on national issues with some concern for the national interest, mm-hmm. and in which everyone could participate equally, and which another advantage to doing it the usual way, the way we elect governors, senators, et cetera, is that it would reduce the comparative power of money. You do hear people say, I've heard a lot of opponents of national popular votes say, yeah, but then that'll be a big advantage for money because, you'll be able to buy commercials or raise money. But in fact, what magnifies the power of money is the way these huge sums can be funneled into just a few places. Mm-hmm. If you got to spread the money out over the whole country, it's going to have less of an impact per voter, even if you spend a lot more of it. Mm-hmm. And there is a limit to how much money you can raise. It's not like right now the parties and candidates are reach the point where they figure, oh, well, we've raised enough money, let's stop. Mm-hmm. They will always raise as much money as they can, mm-hmm. as is humanly possible. But what you can't put a cap on is this, what I was talking about a moment ago, is organization, volunteers, mm-hmm. Grassroots politics. Now, that would be unleashed.
Here's a question. I mean, is it possible that, I mean, one thing that I think leads to this, high intense mobilization at the local level, coffee clatches and so on, is the knowledge that in some of these states, not all that many votes could make the difference, right?
Right.
Now, is it possible that if you went to a true popular vote nationally, in which, there's almost no chance that the margin is going to be a million or less, right? The margin of victory. Is it possible that you would just get less of that stuff in general? And kind of relatedly that, well, I'll let you answer that question.
Yeah. Well, the margin has been less than a million nationally in 1968, 2000,
yeah.
At least one other time, but it, that's not really how it works. If you're going to look at it in a very cold, mechanical, probabilistic way, mm-hmm. one vote, the odds against one vote,
right.
Your one vote making being decisive, are so overpowering.
Well, that's a related question. I mean, from the point of view of the voter, if the question is kind of a sense of engagement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that the kind of sense of engagement they have in Ohio and in Florida is a function of the fact that it's a pretty small space? And, in other words, if you went to a popular vote, is it possible that rather than everyone feel as engaged as voters in Ohio and Florida, nobody would feel engaged because they'd all go, wow, this is such a big country. What effect is poor little me going to have, my vote going to have, right?
Well, I think you could probably that could probably be investigated empirically. I mean, if it's true, then you would expect a lower level of engagement in more populous states.
Mm-hmm.
You'd expect gubernatorial races mm-hmm. to be fought out, to be much less, voters to take much less interest in who the governor is, gubernatorial race in California than in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any evidence for that at all.
Let's move to this, as
you probably have noticed, that people's passions are much more engaged by the presidential election than by any other mm-hmm. election at any level. You know, even though you hear a lot about how, you know, the local government is closer to the people, everybody knows who their president is.
Yeah.
A list of offices.
That's a good
By the
point.
Time you get to school board member, nobody knows who it is, or very few, and or even, you know, state senator or any of that. The,
yeah.
the elections that move people are the biggies. And the presidency is
okay.
the biggest one of all.
Okay, so the obstacle reform would seem to be constitutional amendments are almost impossible to get, you know, and so on. So explain this kind of clever
now, please,
approach
yeah.
that's already made real progress to getting where you want to get.
Yeah, now please stop saying it's clever, Bob.
Okay.
because
well, how
that
about
makes it
a risky scheme.
That's been
focus grouped by Al Gore himself, right?
That was a risky, and we can once this thing is about to happen, we'll start to hear quite a lot of that. We'll hear how
yeah,
it's an
I
end
forget
run.
What he, I forget what he was calling a risky scheme, even, but it was something.
Yeah, it was supply side economics, something like that.
Well, that is a risky scheme in contrast to your. I mean, I actually do support your thing.
Yeah.
So I, if clever. Where I come from, clever is the highest compliment because there are just so few clever people where I come from. But if it's
let's call it an intelligent reform.
Your cerebral campaign, not crusade. Your cerebral campaign. Explain it.
Okay, it's based on the Article 1 of the Constitution, which, as I mentioned earlier, says that the presidential electors shall be appointed, nothing about electing, shall be appointed in such manner as the state legislature may direct. And in all the mm-hmm. states, except for Nebraska and Maine, what the state legislatures have done is to say, whoever gets the most votes in our state gets 100% of our electoral votes. Nothing in the Constitution that requires that. It wasn't true in the early decades of the country. The states can do it any way they want.
Mm-hmm.
That power is plenary. So what the National Popular Vote idea is basically is for states to say, well, instead of awarding all our votes to whoever gets the most votes in our state, we'll award all our votes to whoever gets the most votes in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if we did that by ourselves, if we were the only state doing that, we'd be idiots. You know, we'd be saying if California decided to do that, then they'd have to cast all their votes for Bush or McCain.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else would have to do that. Only California would have to do that. So the deal is that what the states say is as soon as enough states have said they'll do this, have agreed, have pledged to do this, that is to cast all their electoral votes for whoever wins in the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as there's enough states to make 270 electoral votes to elect a president,
right.
saying that, it kicks in. And then, boom, just like that, the entire country is one constituency.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether you live in a state that's passed the National Popular Vote bill. It has to be a bill in the state legislature, identical bills in every state that agrees. It affects you. No matter where you are, you're all everybody's vote's equal. Everybody's vote is worth going after, is worth soliciting, is worth organizing for. You don't have to go to if you're a New Yorker, you don't have to go to Pennsylvania to campaign. You can campaign right at home. It would transform mm-hmm. politics in this country. It would just absolutely transform it. It would have. The number of salutary effects it would have, ranging from giving precedence to national issues over parochial issues, to making stealing elections prohibitively unlikely, to mm-hmm. reducing the possibility of Florida-type recount nightmares. You know, the benefits are overwhelming. And the only reason, I guess, that this hasn't been, once this idea was very cleverly thought of. The only reason it hasn't already
don't say cleverly, but
the only reason it hasn't already happened is the sort of leftover suspicions from the 2000 election. You know, Republicans have reacted to it often, sort of like, this sounds like we're trying to delegitimize Bush's victory. You know,
well, that explains something I was going to ask because first of all, a number of states have now done this. I mean, we're what? Are we a quarter of the way to the finish line or what?
About a quarter of the way.
And the states, and I noticed that you know, in terms of thinking about this, there's no reason that it should be favored, especially by red states or blue states. It should just be favored by non-swing states, because it would reduce the influence of swing states, but there aren't many of those. So,
yes.
I mean, there is not a majority of those. So, in theory, it should have no red-blue bias, and yet I notice when you list the states that have already signed on to this, as I hope you'll do, turns out most or all are blue states, right?
That's right so far. Right now, the states that have said yes, that have signed up are, well, District of Columbia, and then seven states, I guess. Hawaii, well, in order of that they did it, Maryland, New Jersey, Illinois, Hawaii, state of Washington, Massachusetts, and Vermont. Now,
okay.
Most of those, yeah, you're right. Most of those are blue states. And that's, it's
but
really
you're
not.
You're saying that's largely a result of just the fact that we're doing this in the aftermath of the 2000 election. There's no.
Yeah. And it's starting to change now because, as 2000 fades further into the past, Republicans are starting to get interested in this. For example, in California, which would be a biggie, if California adopts this, it'll be almost halfway to happening. In California, the legislature has passed it twice, and Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it. But
mm-hmm.
now, this year, the bill, it essentially got no Republican support. Before. Now, the bill has been introduced in the California Assembly, co-sponsored by the Republican caucus leader and the Democratic caucus leader. And it's got a whole bunch of Republican co-sponsors.
Hmm.
Same in Missouri, where it's got where there's actually more Republican co-sponsors than Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I have such faith that this can happen is not because it's a great good government idea or will make us a more democratic country, but because it is in the interest of politicians of both parties in non-swing states, which are four-fifths or nine-tenths of a country. Because it doesn't matter whether you're in a red state or a blue state, or you're a red politician or a blue politician. If you're in Texas and you're a politician, you have no say. You have nothing to do with the general election. You might, you know, maybe in a primary you've got some clout, but nobody's going to return your calls about the general election.
So you will not be courted by the presidential candidates.
You won't be courted by the presidential candidates. There won't be any money from the campaign spent in your state. Your friends who own the local TV stations aren't going to get any of those high-priced political ads.
Hmm.
So it's in the interest of politicians. You know, they want to be part of the action. They want to play in the game.
Hmm. And you think politicians might do something that's in their self-interest, huh?
I do. Now, you know, there is a catch to that, to this. Some politicians who like things just the way they are, you know, they've got their state legislative district where they always win. They know who's going to vote. The problem with this proposal can be that it will increase voter turnout.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at swing state turnout and you know what we call battleground state turnout and spectator state turnout, there's just an absolute matchup. Turnout's higher in the battleground state. In the battleground states, you get turnout that's on the level of Britain. You know, not Scandinavian maybe, but you get British level turnout.
Mm-hmm.
In the spectator states, you get this kind of pathetic half or less turnout. So if the whole country is a battleground country, then you're going to get then people who don't normally vote in a lot of these states are going to start voting, and that makes some politicians of both parties uncomfortable. So there is resistance by politicians from that. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have more faith in the breed than that. I think more of them want to have fun than just – they want to have fun even if it means they're, you know, 1% less safe than they just want to be safe above and instead of all else. So
you're not projecting your value system onto them, Rick?
I'm sure. Yeah, that's okay. Right. Yeah, I'll trade 1% of safety any day for excitement.
I know you will.
Maybe 10%. I don't know. 10%. That's a iffy.
So I'm for this. I was going to ask, why. It's one of those things where it's a fine idea, but I was going to ask, why is it that the states that have signed on? Because usually something just being a fine idea isn't enough. But I guess you've partly explained it, which is that it is in the interest of some politicians to get it done. And in addition, there are some organizations actively lobbying for this.
Yeah, Google kind of organizations generally, yeah, like Common Cause and League of Women Voters, uh-huh. That kind of thing.
So I support it. I'm curious as to
who doesn't like it actually, who tends to have to react against it, are operatives, professional campaign industry mm-hmm. types, and some political reporters. If this goes through, then a lot of political reporter skill sets.
Oh, totally.
They're gonna be criminologists out of work.
There goes the expense account. I mean, they're not gonna be sent anywhere if they can't be sent. Right?
No, they'll be sent. People are in different places. Geography will play.
Yeah, but it's not. But right now, there are people who are going out to Iowa right now. Political mm-hmm. reporters just to sense, the pulse of Iowa.
Well, as one of the breed, Bob, you probably know that all of that boys in the bus stuff happens a lot more during the primary campaigns.
True.
That's where the big fun is.
True. You're right. So Iowa is irrelevant to this. That's right.
Because there'll still be Iowa. This doesn't affect the primary process at all.
Right.
But for those last couple of months of the campaign, right now the candidates travel all around the country, but mm-hmm. they only go to swing states.
Mm-hmm.
So now they'll go other places. The idea that they'll never go to a state like Iowa because it has a small population, or that there won't be any campaign in those places, is also nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Because these places, for one thing, instead of going to a farm specifically in Iowa, candidates will go to a farm somewhere because they want to get the farm vote.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the calculus will be different.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it won't be just about where does the candidate go. It's the campaigns are going to be much more participatory under mm-hmm. national popular vote.
And I'm curious, whenever anyone is just avidly attached to a cause, I'm curious as to how it happened. I mean, it sounds like mm-hmm. a fine cause, but there are a number of causes. You could be focused as much on nuclear disarmament or whatever. Was there like an epiphany you had or something, or did you just get slowly drawn into the logic of this?
Well, ever since I worked in the White House, ever since I worked for Carter mm-hmm. way back when, beginning then I've been more and more interested in how the mechanics and hydraulics of our system work.
Mm-hmm.
And how that is really the background to everything. And so largely as a way of understanding what's going on, I've gotten more and more interested in the rewards and punishments that are built into the peculiar way our institutions are set up, and less interested in moralistic explanations. Mm-hmm. Like our mutual and dear friend Mike Kinsley often says, he blames the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people want low taxes and big services.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the people here want that any more than the people in Sweden or Botswana. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's what people – I think if offered the choice of having a lot of stuff but not having to pay for it, if that's one of the options, of course they're going to take that option. And mm-hmm. our political system, the way it's so atomized, the mm-hmm. way responsibility is divided among so many different levels and at each level among so many different bodies, the way we have no national government. We have three elected national governments, the House, Senate, and the President, and they all have to agree for anything big to happen. And there's very little in the way of incentives to make them agree. And they're all independently elected, and within them each member is independently elected, so there's no. It's amazing that we've done as well as we have.
Yeah.
And of course, the national mythology overestimates how well we've done. You know, the stuff about gosh darn it, for 220 years we've had this constitution and it has served us well. You know, that overlooks the fact that there was a total constitutional collapse in 1960, and the biggest national problem could not be solved through the institutions, could not be solved peacefully. It had to be solved with a savage war.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of that broader interest in how the Constitution, broadly understood, mm-hmm. affects every damn thing.
Okay, so it's really hard
to get, you know, the reforms I'd like to make are just beyond reach. The beauty of the national popular vote, which would not solve all of our problems or
right.
a majority of, but it would help with quite a few, is that it's achievable. That's what's really lovely about it. It's achievable.
Just out of curiosity, what would come in second place if you could magically implement any reform in the structure of governance?
Oh, if I could magically reform, then I would essentially, I would take the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Germany. You know, I'd put it in a Word document, and then I'd edit it for American needs.
So that's a parliamentary system, first of all, right?
Parliamentary system where the chancellor, the chief executive, is chosen by the lower house of parliament, but cannot be just tossed out. You have to have, in the German parliament, unlike the British, say, you have to have a constructive vote of confidence. You can't get mm-hmm. rid of the prime minister, the chancellor, unless you have a replacement ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the parliament is chosen by proportional representation or a mixture. Mm-hmm. Actually, in Germany, you know, you get two votes. You get one vote for a local candidate for the Bundestag, for the legislature. And mm-hmm. then you get another vote you can cast for a party. And so mm-hmm. the election for the local representative is like all elections. You know, whoever gets the most votes mm-hmm. wins, even if it's whether it's a plurality or a majority, that person wins. And then at the end, you count up you take all of them and who's got, and then you compare the party proportions to this other vote that everybody's cast, and you fill it out mm-hmm. so that the proportions that each party gets correspond to the support each party gets in the final result mm-hmm. Filled in with candidates from a national list.
Unlike Israel,
as long as I'm wonking this, going completely flat out wonkery, unlike.
That's what we're for. That's what this website is
unlike
for.
Unlike Israel, which is a horrible system where you can get 2%. It used to be 1%. I think now with 2% nationally, you can get into the Knesset, where you get a whole bunch of completely insane parties being represented. In the German mm-hmm. system, you've got to get up to 5%. In our system, if you're a minority, if you're any kind of a minority, except a geographic minority, you're screwed. You know, you can get into Congress if you can win a plurality mm-hmm. in a district. But you know, you can be supported by 20% of the population, and you don't get any representation at all. That's from the British system. The British system is maybe the only one worse than ours.
So
I would do that. I would.
So
then you'd have energetic national government. You'd have a government that could try its proposals, and then uh-huh. be judged accordingly. Afterwards, under our system, candidates run for president. They lay out all these visions as if electing them president was going to get these visions enacted. Then when they're not enacted, there's disappointment and a betrayal. And Obama doesn't stand up for us, or Reagan sold us out. It's just a machine for creating disillusion and irresponsibility. And so we live in a country where we worship the Constitution and we think it's the greatest in the world, and it's, and we hate our politics, we hate what it produces. We hate, we never put two and two together and say, maybe if we had a more sensible mechanism, maybe if we could update this 18th century machine, it might work better.
And that is, the virtues of a parliamentary system is something that is also, that I think are also emphasized by the aforementioned Mike Kinsley, right? He's kind of a...
I think so. I mean, the our system is partly the way it is because the framers, who were great cutting edge, brilliant people, but they didn't really see the direction the British system was going in. So they, it's kind of based on the British system with the executive, the president being like the king, and then the House of Lords and House of Commons and all that. But the direction the Brits were going in then, they weren't there yet, but was to make the king a figurehead, and the real big executive is going to be the prime minister chosen through the parliament. So the framers went for this sort of French kind of abstract. We talk about what practical men they were, but actually they read Montesquieu. French theory played a big role in the machine they designed. They just didn't have a lot of experience to work from, and they.
Okay, so in the we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you a little about how the world of new media is treating you. How are you feeling about this whole thing?
Well, I really...
Because we worked together back in the days when, magazines were king and there was no such thing as... Well, we didn't know of such thing as the World Wide Web, whether it existed
it
or not.
It definitely didn't exist. When we were together at the New Republic, actually, I was cutting edge in those days because while I was editor, we brought in computers. They were IBM PCs, with the...
Running Zyrite.
Zyrite, what a great word processor. With those,
wasn't it?
Nice. With the black, you turned it on, you get the black screen, and it would have the letter C in the corner. That's all it would be. Carry the floppy disks around the office. And it was great. And then when I went on the road, when I covered the 88 campaign for the New Republic, I had a trash 80, a Radio Shack.
Yep, TRS-80 Radio Shack.
With a 300 baud modem. And what a miracle. I could take an 800-word story, and in just like 15 minutes, I could send it over a telephone wire back to the New Republic.
Right, but you would have to establish contact. There had to be a person at the other end receiving it. It wasn't like emailing.
That's right. There'd be exactly. There's a modem, and if you'd have to call that phone number, and then you'd get this sound.
Then you'd push it. And you know who brought Nexus to the New Republic, Rick? You probably don't know. That was me in Mike Kinsley's absence when he was away and I was acting editor. Mike being, what would the kind word be? Parsimonious. Didn't like to spend money on stuff. And so I committed us to NexusLexus, and it was there when he got back. That's my claim to fame. And then the internet happened, and then actually separately kind of the World Wide Web. I actually, when I wrote a cover story for the New Republic about the internet as if it was this radical new thing, which it seemed to be, I didn't mention the World Wide Web in it because the browser hadn't happened, and so the World Wide Web was some fundamentally inaccessible place. And anyway, now then it happened, and now you are actually blogging. Who would have guessed?
Yeah, I guess I've been blogging. Now I've been blogging for 7 years, something like that.
Are you liking it?
I do like it. Yeah, I think blogging's fun. Now, although I can't really say that what I do is the real thing. A real blogger is our fellow New Republic ex-editor Sullivan, Andrew Sullivan. That's blogging, man. That is blogging.
That's
writing, what I do, which is maybe one week I'll do two or three posts, maybe four, maybe I won't do one for a whole week. That isn't exactly blogging. It's more like, it's more like writing letters and sending postcards.
Well, I mean, also you pay more attention to the literary quality than many bloggers
do. I
do.
I know. I write slowly and I can't help writing. I can't help
Well, you can tell, though. It's good. They're little literary gems. It's what the New Yorker should have on its website.
Well, that is different. That's certainly the way we spin it. You know, that's our
No, but it's great, and I kind of wish
well,
I had.
Well, you could
a
have
blog,
one, my
but,
God. It's not.
What?
You don't have a blog? You have well, you have an empire, I guess, but.
Yeah, it's a media empire. Hmm. That's what it is. And you are on it. Anything else you want to say about new media or anything?
I'm very glad. The older I get, the more grateful I am for Google. Google, in fact, I can't imagine when your memory starts to go, and it's largely a benign experience. It just means you have to fumble a little more to get a name or a movie title or something like that. But what did they do before Google? I really don't know. And I think
neither of us can remember, and there's a reason.
And
for
this
that,
is
Rick.
Coming. I mean, it will be. It's getting closer to the day where, you know, you're at a dinner party and you can't remember now. What was that Goldie Hawn movie where they'll actually be the wall. Google will actually be in the room there with you, and it will just quietly provide the answer. What do you call the logarithms will have developed to the point where.
You mean it'll just hear you ask the question and intone the answer?
Yeah, you'll turn to the wall and you'll say, now what was that Goldie Hawn movie? You know, I think it had Robert De Niro in it, and bam, the Google will tell you.
Hmm.
I'm sure that's going
to
happen.
I'm not sure I'm looking forward to that day.
Well, you don't want to go back to the. To pre-Google, do you?
Not especially, but I mean, I'm kind of torn about all this stuff. I mean, I've never been a rapid-fire person. Maybe I'm a little like you in that regard. I've always had to kind of reflect. I'm a slow writer. I'm not born for Twitter. And increasingly, it seems like Twitter, I mean, that's not the reason I'm not on Twitter and I'm not blogging. It's because I've gotten distracted by this different kind of enterprise. But I'm not a Twitter type. And increasingly that, is a key ingredient of kind of prominence in journalism, I think, to be involved in do you tweet at all, Rick?
I'm sorry to say, and I don't, you know, that I don't know what it is. I mean, I've seen screenshots
well,
of it.
I'll tell you, I will show you after we get offline, because you would appreciate it as a consumer. It's a valuable, I use it as a consumer. There are people I follow.
Uh-huh.
And I will sing its virtues to you, but being a generator, a content generator in the Twitterverse, can be a time consuming thing. And you gotta be fast. You gotta be really fast. Mm-hmm. Or else your line is stolen.
Uh-huh. But it's a good way to get your line out there and establish precedence for it, huh? So I don't know what the hell it is.
I think that's true. It's good for a lot of things. It's good for calling attention to stuff you've written in longer form. But to do any of this, you have to first become valuable as a tweeter.
But then,
you have to become valuable
to people who devote a portion of their day to reading 140 character messages. Is that true?
Well, you have to become valuable. At a minimum, to fellow tweeter, you have to either have a very large following, a fan base, or be considered valuable by fellow tweeters who will then retweet your stuff. And most of the prominent people have a combination of both, a pretty big fan base and respect among fellow tweeters. Uh-huh. It's a little like the blogosphere in that way. I mean, you probably rely less on reciprocal linking to get traffic than some bloggers, but for those bloggers who do rely on that, it's a pretty close analogy.
Uh-huh.
It just everything happens faster because the utterances are shorter.
So there's a tweetosphere and a blogosphere, but they overlap, I assume. Okay.
Well, they do also overlap. I mean, they are first of all kind of analogous in this sense in their dynamics. There's a certain parallelism, but they also overlap in that what a number of tweets do is direct you to either news stories or blog posts or columns or whatever. So it's a form of publicizing your stuff. And, I mean, I've been enjoying this so much we've gone on long enough that we shouldn't go on much longer. But I will say that one thing I really don't like about the modern world is how if you write something, and more than ever, you are responsible for generating the publicity for it. Mm-hmm. Now, you are insulated from this because you're on this great platform, The New Yorker, both as a website and as a magazine. You got your audience. But more and more, for most people, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, most people are writing for places that will not necessarily be read by the relevant people. You got to get the word out there. So if you remember Marina sitting in on those editorial meetings at the New Republic, you are now your own Marina. And maybe on that inside reference. No, she was a publicity person. I guess we've been doing this an hour, but I've really enjoyed it, and thank you. And where can we will put next to this links to whatever you want by way of sending people to relevant to material that is relevant to your passion. They can be links to things you've written. They can be links to organizations they can join or whatever.
Okay. How do we do that? Should I send you a note or what? By the way, should I press the off thing now or what?
Yeah, I guess at this point we should say a fond farewell and press the off button and then talk offline. Yeah.
Okay.
So thanks a
lot.
Well, it was
my pleasure, Bob. Thank you for keeping after me and taking my virginity.
Well worth the effort. It was a job somebody had to do, Rick.
Bye-bye.
See you.